Welcome to episode 9 of the Decarceration Nation podcast, a podcast about radically reimagining America's criminal justice system. I am Josh Ho, the formerly incarcerated person, among other things. I'm currently a freelance writer, a criminal justice reform advocate, and the author of the book Writing Your Own Best Story, Addiction and Living Hope. Joel?
And I am Joel Barson, and I'm a friend of Josh, and I have a background in affordable and supportive housing.
Cool. So today we're going to be talking about something that's going to be a bit more personally tough for me. I think Joel's going to be doing more interviewing of me this time than usual. And I think that's because today we're going to be talking more about my crime than we usually have before.
Yeah. You know, you and I have been talking about how there might be listeners who wish to understand a little bit more about your background, Josh. It's certainly something that's been alluded to since the very first minutes of our first podcast. But you were mentioning to me that you had received, I think it was a tweet from someone who thought that that putting your background out there might be worth doing.
Well, I mean, I think it's fair to say that I've never really hidden my background. I wrote a book that the first chapter is literally the story of what happened. So, you know, I don't really feel like I've hidden my background. But for people who don't know, I was I pled guilty to criminal sexual conduct for being in an adults-only chat room, talking to an undercover officer who represented as underaged. There are some, I think the popular press story made reference to me soliciting, but I think they were referring to solicitation in a chat room because I never tried to meet anyone and I never got charged with anything like that. That isn't to say in any way, shape, or form that what I did was right. It wasn't. It was wrong. I've taken... You know, I take full responsibility for what I did. I do think it was wrong, and I hope that anyone listening will hopefully learn from my example. You know, I mean, I talk a lot about the book at the beginning, and the reason for that is because I wrote the book after I got out of prison to hopefully be a guide to people who were struggling with similar problems with sex addiction, and in the hopes that they would not make the same mistakes that I did, which is why the first chapter of the book is pretty explicit about.
So, you know, to dwell on this just a second and maybe clarify some things, could you say specifically what it is you feel you did that was wrong?
Well, it's kind of weird. I mean, if I were not... I don't know, it's hard. Sometimes these things are hard to explain precisely without sounding like you're making excuses, because I definitely don't want to sound like I'm making excuses. In my case, I was going to adults-only fantasy chat rooms, which means that no one was supposed to be there who was under 18. Mm-hmm. But I was... The fantasy part of it was this kind of age, what they call age play. Mm-hmm. The thing that I seemed to have, my conscience seemed to have not been, I think it was there, but it wasn't kicking in the way it should have, aside from just why the hell are you doing this in the first place, is that anyone who was in that room could have been representing as under 18. So, you know, I think, you know, even in the, if I were trying to be in total denial and say that nothing I did was wrong, the truth is someone in there could have been under 18. They didn't actually, you know, find someone. You know, it was an undercover officer that I was talking to. But that doesn't mean that it couldn't have happened or didn't happen. So, you know, if I had been talking to someone, or if I did, then that's definitely wrong. You know, there's absolutely no excuse for that.
Right. So you've, as within your book, you've been open about the fact you have an addiction. And is there a relationship between the addiction and your crime?
No, not precisely, although, you know, there's always some relation between things. The relationship between my, really the reason for my crime probably in a lot of ways goes back a lot further than that. And we'll talk about this more, I think, later. But, mm-hmm. you know, as a child, I was both sexually and physically abused. And I don't mean to say that as an excuse for what I did, because it's not. Mm-hmm. But sometimes knowing, you know, one thing we, you know, the research and psychology and all that kind of stuff shows is that there's definitely a pattern that can happen in these kind of cases. You know, in general, they're called cycles of violence, but where abused people become abusers, and that doesn't make it okay, mm-hmm. But it is helpful in figuring out how and why things happen. So for me, part of recovery was going back and really having to dig deep into all of that and come to grips with a lot of the trauma that I had not resolved, which was a lot of the cause of the what I was getting into.
So I wonder if you could explain the crime that you were charged with, what you were convicted of, and the classifications that followed. You know, for instance, I recall you telling me that that you were classified on the registry as having committed a violent crime, and yet you never. Anyway, I wonder if you could explain.
I don't know if I have a very good answer to that one, because as I've said before, a lot of what defines what violence is determined by statute, not by the same logic that we probably use when we think about it. So there is a world in which I can certainly see why my crime would be considered violent, because I think words can be violent, mm-hmm. and I think words can do damage to people. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think I'm hostile to the idea that it was a violent crime in that sense. You know, if you're disrupting someone's life with your words in a way that does damage to them, I think that is violence. Mm-hmm. But when we talk about violent crime in terms of how we punish crime, mm-hmm. what we really are usually talking about is physical harm created to someone else. You know, and that's not up to me to decide. You know, I mean, if that's what violence means, I didn't commit a violent crime. But because it's defined by statute, I committed a violent crime. And again, that doesn't mean, like I said, I see how it could be violent. I'm just saying that in the traditional sense that people define it, that's not usually.
Okay.
Does that answer your question?
I think it does. Thank you. One of the things that you've already sort of hinted at and that I think we want to talk about is the cycles that can lead to further perpetuation of some of these crimes, and also the place in our society that individuals who've been convicted of these crimes then have. I think in part that's been a theme, in a way, or maybe a subtext of many of the episodes that we've done.
One thing I want to say is I've intentionally not made a lot of the episodes about things that directly affect me, because I think my major motivation for the project of this podcast is because I care deeply about criminal justice reform. And that isn't just in my case. I mean, most of the things we've talked about, I've already been through. You know, right. I mean, I've already been through bail. I've already been through a prosecutor. I hope to God that I never have to do it again. But you know, these are not things that I'm facing right now.
And it gives you a unique and important voice when talking about these things, I think. You know, I mean, even just in the last episode when we were talking about your recaps of Orange is the New Black, part of what is unique and impactful about those is your ability to speak from having been there.
Well, at least from the men's version.
Right, you know, right.
Unfortunately. I mean, well, I don't know, whatever that means.
Yeah.
But
yeah. But there are those, Josh, who would say that yours shouldn't be the voice that is out in front when talking about criminal justice issues, that maybe a formerly incarcerated person could could in some way muddy the waters by being part of the conversation. I don't know. Do you want to speak to that?
Yeah. I mean, one thing is I don't really see difference in terms of crimes. I don't ever try to throw anyone under the bus and say these people are a certain kind of criminal and these people aren't. Yeah. Even above, when we were talking about my particular crime, hopefully you notice that one of my goals is to not say that I did this and that means I'm better than the other people who've been charged with this, because I don't feel that way. I feel that reform has to happen for all or it happens for none. And that's why when we talk about just like some of the carve outs we talked about in one of the early episodes or whatever, I'm so passionate about it is because I want, here's a great example. Right now in Michigan, one out of every four people who go to prison has a sex crime. That's a fairly large percentage of your incarcerated population, and it's one of the largest growing percentages.
Right.
And, if we don't speak to that, if someone doesn't speak to that, and we will have episodes, I already have interviews set up with people who are experts in registry reform and stuff like that, that is part of the story. And it's a big part of the story. And there's a lot of other things that we'll talk about, of why I think it's important. Maybe this is a good time to say them. I don't know. But, like, for instance, I think there's a lot of people right now that have been, and I think rightfully, sharing their stories, calling out abuse, and, finally saying, we're not going to allow this to happen anymore. And, I would say, if anything, I'm 100% on, I support that absolutely. Even if it means someone's telling me to shut the hell up, you know, that doesn't mean that I don't believe I have a right to socially exist or to speak the issues that, I think there's a lot of issues that are important that my voice adds something to, mm-hmm. but it certainly doesn't mean that I don't understand, for instance, why someone might be triggered by me.
Right.
Or why, I might not be the right person to talk to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
I do think in this area, it is important, just like in any other area, to have voices who have that subject position talk.
Mm-hmm.
Because otherwise they become another example of caricatures or stereotypes, and they don't ever become human. And I think the entire purpose, if there is a purpose of this podcast, is that everybody, and I mean everybody, at the core is human.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That everybody has their own mistakes that they've made or didn't make. I mean, there may be people out there who've never made mistakes, or have never done anything terrible. And there are probably a lot of people like that. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I know a lot of people who have made mistakes, and I know a lot of them that I care deeply about, you know. And I think that I may not agree with what they did, and I may think they need to be accountable for what they did. In fact, I absolutely think that they have to be accountable for what they did. Mm-hmm. And I think I have to be accountable for what I did. I like to think that I'm trying to be accountable by even speaking in public about this is often very stressful mm-hmm. and scary.
And so part of what you are bringing to light is what I'm hearing you say is that there are survivors out there, many, and that they have a voice, and that we're in a cultural moment where that voice is being spoken strongly and assertively, and that that's a corrective that we've needed as a culture.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And
anyone, and I do believe, and I want to make this very clear,
yeah.
that everyone who has done something like what I did should be accountable for what they've done.
Yeah,
my project is not about,
yeah.
you know, people hear me say, let people out, do this, do that, whatever, decarcerate. I'm not saying that people shouldn't have to be accountable for what they're doing. I'm saying that the way that we go about doing it doesn't have good outcomes.
The other thing is when we bring survivors into this conversation, as we rightly should, and whose voices we all need to hear, and thank goodness we are starting to hear them as a culture, is that in many cases, those who are who have committed these crimes are also survivors themselves. Yes.
Yeah, and I think one of the problems with the way we have this kind of binary that we talk about, you know, people as either abused or abusers, is that a lot of people are both. Most specifically, about a year ago, the first time I remember really feeling this particularly powerfully was there was a counseling center for people who had suffered sexual abuse. And it turned out a couple of people were working there in a janitorial capacity, if I remember correctly, who had a sex offense or a CSC or whatever you want to call it. And some board people found out about it and got them fired. And as a result of that, a legislator in Michigan attempted to pass a law that banned basically anyone who had a sex offense from being in those counseling places at all. There were some other problems with the legislation, which is why that we fought against it, a lot of the groups that I was affiliated with. But one of the reasons is because so many people who have committed sexual crimes were also the victims of sexual crimes. And to say that they shouldn't have counseling says that you're leaving them really no option for really figuring out what's wrong with them and making progress towards not doing those things.
Right.
You know, for me, you know, I give a speech in the addiction community, not all the time, but sometimes, that I call 2010 the best year of my life. And it was crazy because that's the year I got arrested and went to prison. And the reason why I call it that is because it was the first time that I learned or started to learn what had been going wrong in my own life. And if I hadn't have had that experience of therapy and facing my situation and learning from everything that had happened, I would have continued to go in the wrong direction. I don't know what that would mean, but for me to be a better human being and try to work every day to do good in the world, I needed to know what was wrong. And I needed to understand what was going on in my own life. And I couldn't do that without therapy. And so to say that people should be prevented from specialists seems very counterproductive and really kind of dumb to me.
Yeah, it does. So earlier in this conversation, you said that those who have been impacted by abuse should have a right to say shut up to you. Those were your exact words.
And people do.
Okay. Yeah. So how would you articulate?
Not just for that reason.
Right. Yeah. Right. How would you say that both can coexist?
I don't know.
Can they coexist?
I don't know.
Yeah.
That's not my question to answer. It's not my job to tell someone who's been abused how they should hear me.
Yeah.
You know, I do think I have to speak for myself,
mm-hmm.
my subject position,
mm-hmm.
and the idea that I have a right to socially exist, which I think is true.
Mm-hmm.
If for no other reason than I believe very deeply that we pay our debt to society when we serve our sentences. Maybe a lot of people listening might not agree with that, but mm-hmm. that's something I deeply believe. And as long as I'm not doing things, as long as I'm trying to, you know, really do good and be the best person I can be, and I was born in a country that believes in unalienable rights,
mm-hmm.
I believe that I have the right to socially exist. That doesn't mean that people who have been traumatized have to listen to me or they have to believe anything I say, or they can't disagree with me vociferously, you know. And I want nothing more than the same. I want to make sure that those people, as someone who has been abused, I want to make sure that someone in that position feels safe.
Yes.
And so I don't really know the answer to that question, because I believe both of those things and they're not 100% consistent.
So maybe it's an inevitable tension in some way.
I do know, or at least I believe, that there's no way to solve the larger social problem of sexual violence and of unhealthy intimacy without starting to talk about these problems.
Yes.
And that they have initiated those discussions is very important,
incredibly
important. And I think we all have to engage in those discussions if we want them to bear fruit. You know, I mean, I think the best example I could give is, you know, for a very long time in this country, you know, it's not like these alt-right people who showed up in Charlottesburg, you know, that they didn't exist all those years before. What happened is it became more socially acceptable for them to say the things that they were thinking. And so if you take a bunch of people who have not come to grips with the things that they're doing that are harmful, and you tell them, you know, you don't create any spaces for them to find a better way or to have conversations. Or, I mean, I remember very specifically when I first got out of prison, there was a woman in my house who very nice in every way, except that she was, you know, deeply racist. And, you know, I could have just shunned her. But, you know, I would sit down and talk to her for a couple hours about, you know, why I disagreed with her, which may have been, you know, counter, you know, maybe I was banging my head against the wall. But I think it was important to, I think in that process, because she had a, she had the space to speak, there was growth that happened there.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm not saying I corrected her. I'm saying that because we had the conversations, things, you know, act where we both were starting from a position where there was a possibility of discussion, there was positive things that came out of that, and I hope some healing. You know,
I admire that about you. I have to confess that while I, of course, support the right of those who have views that I don't embrace to speak and to gather, I don't have patience to listen to white nationalists or what they have to say, and I am disgruntled that that they seem to be have found a platform.
Well, I think the difference is that people who are dug in on the principle of that racism is okay, I'm not going to have a very good conversation with them.
Okay.
People who are racist and maybe even don't realize it, and we sit down and have a conversation where I ask questions about the things that they're saying,
yes,
is different than me going up to say, what's his name, Richard, whatever his name is, and saying, hey, you're wrong. I don't, you know, I don't think that's going to be very productive, you know, but I think you can have productive discussions with people that aren't in that, you know, locked in position, you know, where they've, their silo is part of their personality.
And maybe in such an encounter, in such a, in a human to human encounter, like the one you described, there is potential for growth maybe on both sides.
Oh, and you know, I mean, you learn, I learned a lot about why she was where she was coming from because of what she'd experienced, you know, and that doesn't make it okay. Just like I said, you know, or way at the beginning of this, my crime wasn't okay.
Yeah.
You know, I had to make that journey to get to the point where I not only saw what knew what was wrong about what I did, but also every how I got there, because that's the only way I could not make the same mistakes again, you know.
I'd actually like to circle back to that, to your speech, 2010, the best year of my life,
which I have given several times. Strange, it's strange, but
well, I think there's a point of connection here that I just want to explore a tiny bit between what you're saying in this conversation and part of the arc of the podcast, so far. And I guess I'm hearing, you know, 2010 was the year that your incarceration commenced, right?
Yes.
And so...
It's also the year I went to... I mean, the reason why that started is because before I got sent to jail and prison, I mean, well, for, you know, for my three-year sentence, before, after I'd been sentenced, I went to therapy.
Yeah.
And that therapist was a specialist, and he helped me. That's why 2010 was the...
I understand that. But cool. let me try to channel a voice of someone who may come at some of the issues we've talked about from a different point of view.
Mm-hmm.
You had been engaged in behaviors that were harmful, and the criminal justice system was activated. It intervened, and it ultimately incarcerated you. You sit before me, a self-reflective, self-aware, humble, and beautiful person today in 2018.
I'm not sure everyone would agree with all that, but...
But what if stipulating... I want to stipulate those things about who you are today, because I believe those things. What if someone were to say it was the very criminal justice system that it appears... we are raising so many objections about that facilitated your growth.
Yeah, well, to some extent, I suppose that's true. It doesn't work the same way for everybody because I've talked to a lot of people in this situation, but being arrested did make me pay attention in a way that I hadn't before. But I would say the transformative moments for me, the really, truly transformative moments were the first time I went to the therapist and he started saying things that I had never heard before and could not deny. And what I mean by that is for the first time, you know, I think this is true, and I've heard this with a lot of people in other kinds of addictions too, but it's definitely true in my experience with sex addiction, is that you believe that nobody else will ever understand what you're going through, that it's something no one else is experiencing, and that you're the only one, that if you ever told anyone, they wouldn't understand and they would never accept you. And the truth is, there are millions of people who struggle with this problem. You see it all over the society, from porn problems to sexual violence to sexually inappropriate behavior. You see it on television every single day. You know, I mean, there's so many times where I'll be watching, like I remember when Anthony Weiner got arrested and I was like, you know, before that he had all those problems and I was just like, man, I know that guy's story. But you feel like when you're in those moments that you're the only one and you can't talk to anyone. And so it becomes this bubble and it gets worse and worse. And so when I went to the therapist and the therapist started telling me exactly what I'd been experiencing, it was very hard for me to stay in denial and think that I was the only person like that. And then I started going to 12-step groups and the people in that area, and people would take me aside and they would tell me their stories, and they were similar to my story in so many ways. It was impossible for me to say, oh, well, you know, that's, I'm the only one. It's not a unique problem. It's a societal problem and one that we don't deal with very well. And I think a lot of that's because we get raised with a lot of unhealthy ideas about intimacy. And there's an awful lot of abuse, you know, lot of people who really don't deal with the idea of healthy. And when I say intimacy, I don't mean sex. I mean even relational intimacy of any kind. And I think part of the process of healing is trying to be better at always fully valuing whoever you're talking to.
Josh, I appreciate your honesty and your openness so much. It's one of the first characteristics of yours that I experienced and was moved by when we became friends. Is there anything that you would want to say before we wind this up?
You know, I mean, just, you know, it is... It's tough because I definitely think there are some tensions. I absolutely understand anyone who, you know, Personally, in the research that I've done, and the therapists I've talked to, and the specialists that I've met, and in the process of writing the book and all that stuff, you know, I really became convinced of the research that suggests that the worst thing that you can do is pile more shame on people, because shame is almost always the start of most violence. I think I've talked to him about him before. There's a therapist named James Gilligan who's written multiple books and done studies on this, but shame is a very big part of. And so what I really try to do is focus on the humanity and healing and accountability as opposed to shame. And so, you know, if there are people, I mean, there's a lot of people that, like I said, for anyone who disagrees or thinks that, you know, I absolutely embrace whatever, you know, you have the right to say whatever and feel whatever you say. I'm not trying to deny that at all. But for anyone who's struggling with any of the problems that I'm talking about, you know, you really need to focus on accountability. You really need to focus on responsibility. And you really need to start working on understanding and healing, in my opinion. And that's a hard journey, you know. It's years of work, you know. But it needs, you know, if you really want to get to the place where you're not, where you can get up every day and feel good about yourself and know that you're doing good things, you have to start that journey, you know.
Thank you so much, Josh.
Yeah, this was definitely a little different than the usual. I just felt like it needed to be covered. And, there's a community of people that, you know, in addition to incarcerated people, I'm also, you know, in a community of people who are what we call registered citizens, but I think what most people call, you know, sex offenders or CSCs. And I want to speak to that too, because it's part of the story and it's an important part of the story. And like I said, we'll have more discussions about that in the future. Although, like I said, the point of this is the whole system and trying to get good outcomes.
Hear, hear. Till next time.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Joel. And
thank you, Josh.
Yeah. All right. Decarceration Nation is available on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever podcasts are aggregated. We are also now available on Spotify. We hope to have you listen to us again soon, and we'll have new episodes soon. Thanks so much.